not something you control, little darling. It's not something you control.
Expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. Broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus, we're also on the web at kuci.org, and we broadcast through iTunes at Public Radio, and you scan down for KUCI, and there it is. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing, and I want to wish you all a happy new year, and this is the 11th year for Writers on Writing, amazingly enough. And we're still here with the addition of a guest host, Marie Stone, and the same wonderful guests, and hopefully excellent show. So thanks for being with us. Today my guest is Melissa Clark. She's author of The Skinny, How to Fit Into Your Little Black Dress Forever, published by Meredith Books. She's also author and co-author of a dozen or more cookbooks. She's a food writer, she's an essayist, so many things. It's going to be a fun hour talking with Melissa. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Great to have you on.
Thank you.
You know, I must say, I don't remember exactly when I came across your book, The Skinny. I wish I could remember, actually, because it's always interesting, you know, what draws us to certain books. And
exactly.
I tend to not read diet books. I did years and years ago, but I don't anymore. And
which is much to your credit.
I mean, there's a new one every week. How can you keep up? But this book, I found it and I started reading it, and I liked it for a lot of different reasons. Probably the first was the tone and the style of the book, because the writing is fun. It's a fun read. It's the format is beautiful. It's just, you know, the perfect sort of diet book for people who hate diet books.
Exactly. Thank you for saying that, because that's what my co-author Robin Aronson and I really tried to do with writing this book. We never read diet books. You know, we always we just considered ourselves, oh well, you know, we know how to lose weight when we have to. You know, we know what to do. We don't need to read those books to tell us. And until we really started thinking about, well, what do we know, and what do we have to say? It didn't occur to us to even write one. But you're right. This is the diet book for people who don't want to read diet books.
So talk about then how it came about. I mean, did the two of you just sort of, you know, were you sitting down over a bowl of pasta one day?
Saying, what are we doing eating pasta? No. You know, it came about because, you know, Robin and I had been friends since college, and she's known me, I mean, I'm not going to tell you how many years, but let's just say it's a lot of years. And over those years, you know, my career as a food writer, I am paid to eat, to go out to eat, to cook at home, to test recipes for different chefs. And I've always been immersed in food. And Robin knows that in college I lost a lot of weight, and I kept it off through my entire career. And a couple of years ago, she had gained some weight after a pregnancy. She had fabulous twins who are now 3 years old. And after the pregnancy, after she lost the initial, you know, pregnancy weight, she still had 30 pounds, which weren't budging. And that's when she said to me, okay, wait a second. You know, I know you once lost a lot of weight, so I know that you're not just a naturally skinny kind of person who just does, you know, can eat whatever she wants and never gain weight. I know that's not you. I have seen you lose weight and keep it off despite your career. What are you doing? And, you know, until she said that to me, I never really thought about what I was doing. It was just so, it was something that I had developed that had become such a part of me, the way I ate, that I never thought about breaking it down. And in my conversations with Robin, I realized as I started to kind of analyze how I thought about food, how I thought about what I wanted to eat, how I limited certain things, and I, you know, ate in moderation, and just all the tricks that I would use for my own self, when I started breaking it down, Robin said, okay, you know what, there's a book here because, you know, you think that this stuff is stuff that everybody knows, but in fact it's not. Mm-hmm. And then we just started, you know, and then she said, okay, let's write a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how the best books come about.
Yeah, I think so. And it just, it was very organic. It was very, it was just this conversation. And so what we tried to do in the book was keep the conversational tone of two best friends talking about food. And, you know, the thing about the skinny and the thing about this whole book is we love food. I'm a food writer. Robin is just a great eater. We just love to eat. So there's none of that, like, punitive diet, like, oh, you know, don't eat this and don't eat that. It's all about the stuff we love. And I think that really comes across.
It does. And even though the subtitle is How to Fit Into Your Little Black Dress Forever, this is also a book for guys.
Absolutely. Little black suit or favorite pair of jeans.
Or that spandex, that Speedo bathing suit, whatever. Whatever.
Well, exactly. I mean, and you know, the thing about it, though, and the reason we keep saying it's a diet book for people who don't read diet books, it's a diet book for foodies. It's a diet book for people who love food, but who want to maybe shed a couple of pounds. And I feel like most of us go through a time, you know, whether it's a couple of pounds here or there, or whether it's, you know, more weight loss, like, you know, upwards of 10 pounds, 20 pounds, 30 pounds, we all go through periods when we want to take off a little bit of weight. And this, what the skinny does is gives you, in addition to giving you great, you know, recipes that really taste good and that are made for, you know, people who love food, it also gives you techniques and tips. Just kind of a way to go through your day and, while not obsessing about food, just think about what you're eating. And we find that when you're really thinking about your food and when you're thinking about what you're about to put in your mouth, you enjoy it more. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what we're saying is eat the things that you love, because if you really love them and you're in the moment when you're eating them, you're probably going to eat less.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, excellent point.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Melissa Clark, co-author of The Skinny, How to Fit Into Your Little Black Dress Forever, published by Meredith. Writers, and probably a lot of other professions as well, but we writers have a tendency toward the writer's spread because we like sitting and writing and thinking and reading and all the things that burn a calorie an hour or something,
exactly.
Unless you fidget a lot. What can you say to writers, and what advice do you have for writers?
Well, you know, I know writers, I don't know if everyone else does this, and I think we all do, we're a procrastinating lot, you know, like sitting down and writing that first sentence is so hard. And one of the things that I used to do to procrastinate was eat. And I don't know if a lot of other writers find themselves nibbling, running to the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
you know, opening the fridge, doing anything but sitting down in the chair and writing. You know, that's the kind of tip that we would bring up in the skinny is, okay, instead of doing that, instead of getting away from your desk because you don't want to face the, you know, editing that paragraph that is giving you trouble, instead of going to the fridge, this is a time to go into the kitchen and make yourself a cup of tea instead of finding the cookies or finding the, you know, the pasta from last night's dinner and finishing the entire thing. You know, here, do something like, you know, we have other things to do. For example, why not go and do something nice for yourself, like do 10 minutes of yoga or just go take a walk around the block. Do anything but let yourself, you know, give into nervous eating. And I think that that applies to writers a lot. And, you know, we do sit. I sit at my desk constantly. And getting up and moving is another thing that I recommend to anybody with a desk job, but especially writers. I think it clears your head to exercise. And when I say exercise, I mean just move. Stand up. You know, bend over. Stretch. Go for a walk. Do something where you're moving your body, and that will help you with your waistline, and I think it helps with concentration, too.
Yeah.
Do you find that? Do you find you need to take little breaks to kind of move? And
I do. Unfortunately, my computer is too close to the kitchen, so...
Exactly.
So I need to move on past the kitchen and out the door, and so often that's where I stop. It's, oh, you know, let me just do something here. I shouldn't go out because I'll lose my train of thought. When, in fact, when you do just go out for that little walk or just do something, you immerse yourself even more in what you're doing, which is ironic.
I think actually going into the kitchen and making yourself a snack, it takes will divert you much more than trying to stay in the moment, stay in your thought, and taking a walk around the block. I really believe that. Because then you're in a whole other universe. And even when you're writing about food like I am, if I'm writing about, say, right now I'm in the middle of writing about pork chops, but if I go into the kitchen and make peanut butter and jelly, well, forget the pork chops. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that is a problem. Most writers do work at home, and it's just all too easy to find your way to the kitchen.
Right. So that's something which I would say if you want to go to the kitchen, make a cup of tea be your go-to treat. And don't make it a cup of tea with nothing in it. Try to add a little bit of something yummy. Robin and I like to say that we like to make big milky cups of tea with a little bit of sugar because it gives you a sensation of satisfaction because of the milk and the sweetness. You feel like you're getting a snack. So make that your go-to thing. When you get up and go to the kitchen, think, tea with honey or tea with sugar, something yummy, a little bit yummy anyway, as opposed to Haagen-Dazs ice cream.
Well, yeah, and that's the other thing I like about your book is that in terms of dieting, you're not talking about overcoming your desire for sugar or for sweets or good things. You're saying, you know, have one, don't have the whole box.
Exactly. We say, if you want a cookie, have the cookie, but don't eat the entire box of cookies. Because we find that if you really want something, if you crave a particular flavor, if you deny yourself that flavor, even if it's a cookie, which should be off limits, you're going to probably eat everything in your house, and then you're going to go ahead and eat the cookie anyway. So just start with the cookie. You know, don't eat an entire package of rice crackers because they're not cookies.
So. Yeah, yeah.
Which I know I've done.
Yeah.
Ooh, rice crackers, they're sort of cookie-like, but
sure.
In fact.
Now, you mentioned exercise earlier, and a lot of writers tend to have an aversion to exercise. And so when they hear about, I need to exercise or start an exercise program, so often they don't even begin because they know they're not going to keep it up. Talk about that and how even that 10-minute walk or that 10-minute spin through, you know, yoga can just be beneficial and helpful, and you don't have to feel that you have to join a gym to get any benefit from moving.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that same reaction. They think, exercise, I have to go to the gym 4 times a week and spend an hour each time, and then that just seems undoable because we set ourselves up with these huge expectations, which we're just not going to fulfill them. I mean, I know very few people who can stick to an intense exercise program, you know, the thing that they think, okay, I'm going to go to the gym 3 times a week for an hour each time, and I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. Most people I know will stop after a couple of months because it's too much. What I do, and what I think is an approach which works better for a lot of people, is to just integrate a little bit of movement. I mean, exercise just means moving. You don't have to go to the gym. You can walk. You can garden. You can clean those books on the top shelf, you know, by stretching. Just move 10, 20 minutes a day. And if you do it every single day, you'll find that you're going to learn, your body's going to actually want that time. I mean, it feels good to stand up. Doesn't it feel good to get out of your chair? It does,
yeah,
to me.
Yeah.
And I really think that if you take that time as Think of it as 20 minutes or even 10 minutes to yourself every day that's just yours. And you can think about anything you want. You can think about what you're going to wear, you know, for that hot date, or you can think about, you know, you can revel in some memory, or you can work on a difficult passage. You can do whatever you want. Those 20 minutes are yours. And when you combine the idea of giving yourself that time and not making it a punitive thing, like I have to exercise, when you combine the idea that it can be a mental pleasure as well as something physical, I find that makes it a lot easier, and I find that I look forward to that time. Personally, I'm a big runner. I mean, running is an exaggeration. I jog very slowly. I jog. Most people who speed walk pass me. But I get out there, and I do it for half an hour. I don't go very far. It's my mental relaxation time. Writers, I think, also some writers tend to be a little neurotic, like I am. So, you know, it's like, it's my stress-free time. It's mm-hmm. You know, look at nature time, and I wouldn't give that up. And even if I do it once a week, it's okay. You know, I try to do it as often as I can, but if it's once a week, that's great too.
Why does it seem as though those last 5 to 10 pounds are the most difficult to lose?
I think it depends on how much you're losing. I mean, if you're starting from a place of losing 20 pounds, you know, by the time you've lost 15 of them, you've done so much. Chances are you've really spent a lot of time on this, especially if you're following a diet and you haven't just adjusted your eating, if you're actually doing something that's completely new, which the skinny is not about following a diet. It's about just making little changes to the way you already eat. And after you've done that, most people give up. They thought, you know what, they think, okay, enough is enough. I don't have to lose those last 5 pounds. And they lose their momentum. And once you lose your momentum, you know how hard it is to get it back. So, I mean, that's the same with dieting. It's the same with writing. You know, when you just get off the track, it's hard to get back on and finish that last little bit. Like a book, isn't it? I always find that the last revision is the hardest because mm-hmm. I don't want to do it anymore. I'm sick of it. I'm tired of it. And I think it's the same for a diet, which is why it's always better, instead of thinking about losing weight as something, as a limited thing, like, okay, I'm going to go on a diet for a month and lose weight. What the skinny encourages people to do is think about this being a new way to live, a new way to approach food. And then, you know, as Robin says, she's been on the skinny now for 3 years. She's not on a diet. She just eats differently, and that's how she wants to eat, and she feels great, and she hasn't gained a pound back. Same thing with my mother, who lost 85 pounds doing the skinny. And, you know, it's not a diet. She's been doing it for years. It's just the way she eats now. So I think when you make these changes and you make them slowly and you make them in the way that you want to make them, you know, it's up to you. You make the choices. You'll stick to it.
So how long should you wait to see any results?
You'll see them immediately. I mean, you'll really, you know, the first couple of pounds come off really easily, so you will start to see results quickly. We do give a 2-week jump start little black dress diet when you absolutely mm-hmm. have to fit into that little black dress in 2 weeks. So if you want to start there, you can. But even, you know, the way Robin started was she just gave up her mid-afternoon snack, you know, her bag of potato chips, and substituted a big cup of milky tea. Then the next thing she did was added fruit and vegetables with every single meal. Another big part of the skinny is eating more fruits and vegetables, because I think that we all mean to eat them, but I don't think that we necessarily do eat as many fruits and vegetables as we should. And they're so delicious, and they're so good for your body. And so before you even take out anything, before you even say, okay, I'm not going to eat the hamburger, just add in a salad. You know, add in a gorgeous, you know, juicy orange. You know, add that into your diet, and you'll find that you'll fill up on these low-calorie, really healthful foods, and maybe you won't eat all of the fries with your burger.
Mm-hmm.
So, little by little, you know.
Sure. It's, as you said, it's a lifestyle thing. It's changing the way you eat and how you think about food over time, and not you know, going on a diet for a few months.
Exactly. It's a permanent thing. And eating more fruits and vegetables is really a big part of it. We say find your inner Eve. Find that place in your soul that loves whatever kind of fruit or vegetables you love. You know, say that you only like bananas. Okay, fine. Eat bananas every day. Just find the things you love and eat those. and eat them often, and, you know, make sure you're getting the best apples you can find. I mean, I know that I make sure to go to the farmer's market to get really crisp, good apples this time of year. I take that extra effort because I know that if I get the really good ones, I'll eat them. You know, if I get those supermarket ones that are kind of mealy, I may not eat them. So treat yourself well, and get the things that you like. For example, another great thing to do is have your favorite salad dressing on hand. Always have a big jar of it, something homemade and delicious with good extra virgin olive oil and fresh lemon juice and garlic. Keep it in the fridge, and then all you have to do is bust open a bag of, you know, baby greens and pour it on, and it's going to just taste better because you've made it yourself and because, you know, it's flavors that you know you really enjoy.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent tips. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Melissa Clark, co-author of The Skinny. Would you read to us from The Skinny before we move on to other things?
I'm sorry, would I?
Read to us?
Oh, absolutely. Let me read you the introduction.
Okay.
Which kind of explains a little bit about what we mean by the little black dress diet. The perfect little black dress. Every woman has one. The sexy number she just had to buy and probably paid way too much for. The designer frock she pulls off the hanger whenever she has a hot date, a CNBC cocktail party, or fancy dinner. It's the off-the-rack equivalent of a best friend. Dependable, flattering where and when she deserves it, a partner in crime. It's the ubiquitous clothing item that's ready to support her through thick and thin. Preferably thin. And there's the rub, the staying thin. We've all had that horrifying, did the dry cleaner shrink my dress moment? That flash when you realize the chapter in your life when you could eat whatever you wanted and not gain weight is unfortunately over. And now you have to do something about it. But what's your plan? Are you going to give up ice cream for a month? Turn your back on your true love, the chocolate chip cookie? Refuse another sip of cocktail? Ban the bread basket? Live on bacon and eggs? No. You've tried those tricks, and even though you may have lost some weight, you always put it back on. That's because at some point you remembered how good pizza and guacamole-dunked tortilla chips taste, or you couldn't come up with a good reason not to have the brownie that chatted you up while you waited to pay for your nice big green salad. Before you know it, it's so long, little black dress. Hope to see you again soon. Thus, the ineffective and torturous dieting cycle begins anew. But not this time, because you are about to embark on an eating adventure that will last a lifetime. The Skinny offers you an approach to meals that will keep you not only looking fabulous, but also feeling satisfied with what you eat, because no foods are banned. After all, food is one of life's great joys, and we say, dig in. The Skinny's not-so-skinny beginning. We, Melissa and Robin, decided to write The Skinny because we like to eat. But we didn't like being told what to eat and what not to eat. We wanted to make those decisions for ourselves. Sure, being told exactly what to have at each meal works for short-term weight loss, but keeping the weight off for months and years, that requires a better strategy. We know because both of us have been there and done that on the weight loss front. We're long-time friends who lead very different lives. Melissa does the single, sophisticated girl about town thing, and Robin does the family thing. We started talking about how to eat, conversations that turned into The Skinny, a year after Robin had twins. Robin was struggling to lose the last 30 pounds of pregnancy weight, but the only thing she knew to do about it was complain to her size 2 friend, Melissa. Really, Robin whined, how could she possibly diet when that would mean being food-deprived on top of being sleep-deprived? Then one day, Robin decided to stop complaining and ask Melissa for advice. Why Melissa? Because she's a size 2 and a food writer. Because she's able to give advice with attitude but without condensation. And because Melissa once weighed a lot more, but she lost the weight when she was 23 and has kept it off, all the while building a career centered on food and going out to eat. As a food writer, Melissa not only eats in restaurants most nights of the week, but when she's at home, she's writing cookbooks with some of the best chefs in the world. Big names, like Daniel Ballou and David Boulay. Pastry chefs, like Claudia Fleming. And when you write a cookbook, you cook all the food in it, and then you eat it, at least some of it. You have to. It's your job. Every single day. Most people Melissa meets, not just desperate new moms looking for a way back to their pre-pregnancy weight, ask her how she maintains such a sleek figure while eating in some of the best restaurants in the world. Robin paid close attention to what Melissa had to say about eating. Melissa said that no food is forbidden because of her job, Melissa will eat anything, and she means anything. But all foods are subject to limits. She said that when she really wants to enjoy what she's eating, When she really enjoys what she's eating, she doesn't feel deprived. She makes sure to include fruits and vegetables with every meal, even if that means ordering a salad on the side of your foie gras. Then, of course, she talked about exercise. Yes, do it. Robin followed Melissa's advice and started paying attention to what she ate. On Melissa's plan, to her surprise, Robin never thought, I can't have that peanut butter cup, or I'll never eat another bagel again, because no food was outlawed. The plan didn't feel like a diet. Instead, it felt like a fresh new approach, which soon morphed into new eating habits. More fruit for snacks, loads of veggies at mealtimes, smaller portions, and the cookie that Robin always wants at the end of the day. And then a weird thing happened. Instead of losing the last 30 pounds, she lost 40. Now Robin's the thinnest she's been since college, and the weight isn't coming back on. And people started asking how she did it. So here's how, Life on the Skinny.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
That was fun. That was Melissa Clark reading from The Skinny, How to Fit into Your Little Black Dress Forever, published by Meredith Books. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Melissa will still be with us, and we'll talk about the writing, the food writing, the writing of cookbooks, and all that. So don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, ache and tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org and what else? iTunes. Go to public radio and scan down for KUCI, and there we are. We also podcast. If you go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left side of the page. You'll arrive at the radio page. You'll see the schedule, and you'll also see instructions for getting to the podcast. There's 200-plus shows up at this point. This one will probably go up within the next few weeks. It's a great way to listen again. You know, you miss parts. If you're driving, you get out of the car, you get back in the car, you can listen again. If you're at home, you're doing things, you walk away, you can come back. You can subscribe so that the podcast will fall into your iTunes mailbox as well. So, anyway, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, And my guest today is Melissa Clark, author of The Skinny and a plethora of cookbooks and other things. Hi there.
Hi there.
So tell us how you found your way to food writing. I know you were a caterer and a cook prior, but how did it all happen?
Well, you know, my first love was actually writing. And, you know, I wrote since I could. I always wrote stories. But I was not really encouraged to be a writer as a career. You know, how are you going to support yourself kind
mm-hmm.
of thing. So
sure.
I thought, okay, I'm going to be a lawyer. This is what I was going to do in high school. And so food was my other big love. And as I started to grow up and really think about career choices, I realized, okay, law was not really going to, it was not going to be the thing that I didn't love it. Like I loved food and like I loved writing. So I thought, okay, I'll pursue the food side of it since it seemed like I could be a chef. And this was, again, I was still in high school at this point, and I thought that I would go to the CIA, which is the Culinary mm-hmm. Institute of America, and I would become a chef, and that was my plan. And my wise parents said, well, why don't you work in restaurants first and see if you really like it? So I spent a summer doing an internship in the kitchen of a restaurant, and as much as I loved cooking, I realized I hated restaurant work. It was too hard. It was, you know, I mean, it's really, the stereotype really is true. You know, chefs yell at you. There's lots of knives and hot things flying around. And I'm a huge klutz, so I was constantly dropping things. And I was so nervous and so young. And as my parents were hoping, I think it scared me out of becoming a chef. But it did kind of cement my love of food, and it made me realize that there were other options as well. You know, I could food could become part of my life in a number of ways, although it wasn't really clear what I wanted to do. And but it also brought me back to writing, because at that same time I discovered M.F.K. Fisher, who's a very famous
mm-hmm.
writer, and not just people remember her as a food writer. She really didn't write about food. She wrote about love. She wrote about life. She wrote about sex. She wrote about sensual pleasures, and food was part of that. And I fell in love with her writing, and it just brought me right back to all the stories I had written when I was growing up. And so when I got to college, I started focusing on writing, and I thinking the whole time, not thinking I would be a food writer necessarily, but thinking that food would always be a part of my prose, because it was becoming the way I saw the world. You know, it was my metaphor. Everything was related to food in some way. You know, in almost like at that point, a lot of it was cliched, you know, like somebody's expression was sour pickle or something. You know, it was like these kind of, you know, these types of metaphors, but it just informed almost every sentence I wrote, if I wasn't even writing directly about food, I was writing indirectly about it. And I was cooking the whole time. I cooked for myself. I moved off campus my second year of college, and I started cooking for myself. And I started working in gourmet shops and learning more about food. And so I was doing these two things, not really sure what I was going to do with it all. And then I graduated from college, and I went to graduate school because I didn't know what else to do. So I got an MFA in writing. And again, at this point, I was writing fiction and nonfiction, but nothing really about food. I was trying my hand at essays. I was exploring my voice. I thought about writing biography. I thought about writing historical novels, and I just kept coming back to food. And finally, when I graduated, I realized that I really needed to, you know, here it was, you know, do or die, I need to make a living, and I was going to do it as a writer, you know, somehow. And I thought about magazine writing, and restaurant criticism was, you know, I could start there, I thought. And it went from there, and I started out very, you know, typically for magazines, I just pitched to editors, I tried to make contacts, luckily, I stumbled onto this great, you know, internet, which at that point, this was 1994. So all the websites that we take for granted now didn't exist, and people needed, quote, content providers. And I remember thinking, well, is that writing? Do they need writers? So I became a content provider for all these websites, and I started writing about food in a major way. And I started doing restaurant reviews in New York, and then I started writing about ingredients. I started developing my own recipes. And at the same time, you know, knowing that there were other things I wanted to write to that weren't directly about food, but again, that anything I wrote would be informed by it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You write beautiful essays, too. I came across one of your essays in Victoria, in the November-December issue of Victoria, about cookies.
Oh, yeah, my cookie article.
How did that come about?
Well, I mean, I'm obsessed with cookies. That's one thing.
Who isn't?
I can't give up. I eat cookies every day. You know, that's my way of living life on the skinny. Cookies every single day. And you can do it. So, you know, writing, it's such a pleasure to really give yourself to a subject, isn't it? When you love something and it's something that's so easy to get your head around, like a cookie, I just find that's the most fun kind of essay to write, because you just give yourself over to that subject. You know, when you love, especially when it's cookies and it's not extremely serious. But, I mean, again, you know, what I was really writing about in that essay was I was writing about my love for cookies, but I was also writing about falling in love with my husband.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, food is the metaphor. You know, I fell in love with a man who understood my love of cookies and who, and I rejected another man who didn't understand my love of cookies. And it sounds like, how is this going to make sense? But it does.
So when you started the piece, did you know what it was about, or did you have it all figured out and then you wrote it?
I never have anything figured out when I sit down to write. I never know what I'm going to say until I say it. And then I just start writing. I just start with whatever's on my mind. And this is something that a writer, I forget who it was, but, you know, when I was in the MFA program, a lot of writers came in and talked to us, which was great. And one of them said, just sit down and write. Just put your pen to paper, you know, open the Word document, you know, mm-hmm. and just start writing. And that's how I do every single time. I don't know what I'm going to say. And then I go back, and then I read what I've written, and I realize, oh, this is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. So how many revisions might you put an essay through? How many revisions did this one go through?
That one only went through probably two revisions, because I was pretty clear where I was going.
Mm-hmm.
Once I started writing it, I realized, oh, okay, this is what I want to say. Some things go through three or four. Generally, I get it right in about three or four. I write a column right now for the New York Times called The Good Appetite, which are these food essays that go with recipes.
Mm, what day is that?
That's on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
There's if you go to the New York Times website and just type in Melissa Clark, they'll all come up.
Okay.
And now that it's free, it's you can find them all. And those I have to do under, those are great because I have to do them under deadline. I have to do one a week, and I have a limited amount of time to do them because I give myself a limited amount of time. And this is another good exercise, I think. Give yourself one day to write an essay, and you have to do it in a day. And you really, I find that I'm so much more productive with a deadline. You know, deadlines are lifelines, and that really works for me. So those go through two revisions because that's all I have time for.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, and I could be totally wrong, but I would imagine that because you have a ton of cookbooks out there and you've done a lot of food writing over the years and have really established yourself, that the pitching, that the whole process of publishing in magazines and even books has become easier than it was at the beginning.
Well, I mean, it gets easier as it gets easier because I know more people. I feel like so much of publishing and getting your pieces into magazines and getting books published is being in the right place at the right time and who you know and being open to things when they come your way. I mean, yes, of course, you need to be talented and you need to actually sit down and do the work and have something to mail out. But when an editor, you know, when you meet an editor, wherever you might meet them, you know, or if you contact someone and send someone an email and they say, oh, sure, you know, send me the work, you have to send it.
Right.
So, you know, you have to be open to the opportunities that come your way. You have to take advantage of them. You have to be there. And I find that the reason that gets easier is because I meet more people. You know, I have more
mm-hmm.
contacts, so it's easier to get people to listen to me and to read what I'm going to write. And then, of course, you know, once you know people, it goes from there. You build momentum is what happens. But at the beginning, it's just, you know, send the initial email to an editor you've never met, and if you get a response, then you need to act. Then you don't say, oh, I don't have anything to send. I'm not, what can I do? You know, if you're paralyzed at that point, that's you have to overcome that.
Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, would you focus on publications you wanted to be in, or would you just focus on the piece you wanted to write and later worry about where it went?
A little of both. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there were things I had to say. You know, there are some pieces I've never had published. I've just written them, and maybe one day they'll get published somewhere. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's just things that you have to say that you just have to write. I find, though, that those are much harder to sell. It's much easier to work with an editor on a pitch. One thing I learned, though, just for magazine writing, and I think this was really another helpful piece of advice that I got from someone who came to speak to us at Columbia. They said, when you pitch an editor, never pitch one idea alone. Always pitch ideas, you know, together. So pitch two or three things at a time. And the reason this writer said was because at the first pitch, they think, oh, well, no. You know, no, that's not for us. Then they read the second pitch, and they think, well, that's not for us either, but I feel bad saying no. So by the time they get to the third pitch, they feel so guilty about saying no to three pitches that they might actually let you, you know, work with you on another pitch. They might, you know, extend themselves a little bit more because they feel guilty about saying no.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if this is true or not, but because of that, I always pitch in threes.
And will you pitch essays too? Essay ideas, or just write the whole piece?
No, with anything. I mean,
mm-hmm.
unless I need to write it for my own reasons, in
right.
which case I write the whole thing. But I don't generally, mostly I work with the magazines first and try to get a sense of what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's better because you also don't, you could write something and it could be, say that you want to write on a subject that's very dear to you, whatever it is, and you could take that subject in several different directions. And say that you decide to take it in this one direction, that could be the direction that they've already done that piece in, and you just didn't know it. Or they rejected that direction for a reason that you don't know about. So I would start with the subject. Say that you want to talk about the environment or something, you know, that there's some issue you want to talk about. Talk to, I don't know, for example, like recycling in Brooklyn, which is something which I would like to talk about. There's so many ways that could go. I would talk to an editor and say, you know, I'm really upset about the way we're recycling, and this is what I'm thinking, and develop it with the editor. Plus, if you're able to have that kind of access to an editor and you can develop it with them, and even, again, you don't need to know them. You can do this, just send them an email. You know, you can do this blind. But if they have some input in it, they will feel more connected to the piece, and it's more likely to run.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am here with Melissa Clark, author of The Skinny and a lot of other things, cookbooks and essays. The tone of The Skinny, again, is so chatty and conversational, and even certainly it's not fiction, but has the tone. I can really hear you writing fiction or hear what it might be like if you did. And you said that you used to work on fiction a bit.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you've ever thought of writing a novel, sort of a food novel. Since,
you know, I have.
I love food novels.
It's definitely going to, it's on the back burner.
Uh-huh.
I think I will. You know, I feel like there are two projects I really want to do before I stop writing, whatever that is, and I know I have time to do them, but one of them is to write a food memoir,
mm-hmm.
which I'm, and I think that one is more of a burning thing for me to do, so that would be nonfiction. And then I also want to write a food novel and a food love story, and I think I will do those things, you know, at some point. They're both kind of in progress, you know, I think about them, but I haven't actually committed to them. The first thing that I think I'm going to do, though, right now is I'm going to collect my essays that I've been writing for The Times and put those into a book and start out tying those together with kind of memoir pieces that give a little peek into my history with food and start there. And then after I do that, I think I'll be in better shape to do a more serious food memoir.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So, you know, start with the little steps. I always start with baby steps, the little essays, and then move on to the big books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you read food novels?
You know, I don't, and I used to, but now I'm so immersed in food that
mm-hmm.
I read 19th century fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And every couple couple of books I think, okay, now, you know, you really need to read something from, like, the 21st century or at least the 20th century, and then I do. I try to mix it up a little. But my true love, 19th century novels.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the middle of a Charlotte Bronte right now. So,
oh, yeah, well.
You know,
well,
I love those books.
Yeah, me too. Let's talk a little bit about cookbooks. I think cookbooks are one of those areas that a lot of either food writers or wannabe food writers imagine would be a wonderful thing to do, but how exactly to go about it, and then how possible is it even to publish a cookbook unless you are a major chef? Can you offer any advice or tips in that area?
Yeah, you know, I feel like the cookbook market is changing, and it changes really rapidly. It's not the same market as it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And so I've kind of, you know, people often call me for advice on how to write a cookbook or break into the cookbook business, and I feel like I've been altering what I say. I constantly alter it because the market just changes. It changes as quickly as the magazine market. And so a year or two ago, I might have said, okay, well, you know, why don't you start out by co-authoring cookbooks with chefs? You know, you do need to be a big name, and to kind of break in, why don't, you know, since you're the writer and they're the chef, find a chef that you admire. If you're a food writer, you probably know a lot of local chefs. And start to develop a cookbook concept with the chef and do it together. But now, even chefs can't get cookbooks published as easily because people really want home cooking. So you think, okay, great, you know, to do a book on home cooking, I can do that by myself, which is true, you can. But every publisher wants what they call an alternate platform. They want you to have a presence in the world. So my latest piece of advice for people is start blogging immediately. You know, you need to develop an audience. You need to develop a platform. You need to develop a public voice that people can easily find. So a step number one to writing a cookbook, and I really did just say this to a blogger the other day who was asking me, I said, work on your blog, get your blog out there, write your best stuff, write the stuff that you care about, and try to get people to read it. And from there, do a cookbook, not necessarily from the blog. You know, you can start something new, but to have a presence out in the world is the most important thing. And again, when you're thinking about writing a cookbook, you do need to see what else is out there. You need to see what kinds of books people are writing. But you also need to listen to yourself, and you really need to think, what do I want to say? You know, the first question is, what do I want to say in a book? It's one thing to write a cookbook, and it's another thing to know why you want to write it and what you want to say. And so figure that out first. And once you figure it out, don't go off track. You know, don't write... a lot of people come to me with ideas for, like, kitschy cookbooks that they think will make a lot of money and that they can sell really easily. And I always say, if it's your passion and that's what you want to write, great. But if it's just this idea that you came up with because you think it'll make a lot of money, I wouldn't necessarily go there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's about, especially in the market right now, there are a few cookbooks that do exceedingly well, and then everything else kind of does moderately. So.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are your first book is going to do moderately, so make it a book that you're proud of and that you love.
And also, just the idea of somebody wanting to make a lot of money with a book. It's like, get an MBA and go into banking.
Yeah, I know. I love people who are not in the publishing world. You know, I had this doctor say to me the other day, it was actually a funny story. My husband was having minor surgery, and his physician was trying to talk to me about writing a cookbook. And I was thinking, and he was like, oh, we could make a lot of money if we partner up and do this cookbook. And I'm thinking, you're a surgeon. You're already making a lot of money, way more than I'm ever going to make, and it's a really dumb idea. So.
Oh, that's funny.
But, you know, everyone thinks they can write a book. And some of us can, and some should try. And then the people who have, you know, other careers should just focus on that.
Yeah. So your advice on blogging to create a presence, I think, is a really good idea. Now, if you're doing that, you know, to create a platform so that you have a better chance at selling a cookbook or a food-type book, how much would you give away on the blog? I mean, would you post recipes? Would you... post a recipe now and then and mostly have it be narrative, what would you do?
I think that you could give away that stuff. I don't think people will think they don't have to pay for it. As long as the book is different enough, then you're fine. I mean, you're not going to obviously just take your blog and put it between two covers, because that is actually not going to work as a book anyway, because blogs tend to, you know, they're very particular. The voice is very particular, and you'll need to write more, and you'll need to fill it out, and you'll need to make it, you know, into a book, whatever that means. But I think every blog, I don't know any blog that could just be taken straight off the page. They need some editing. So that in and of itself is different. And then you can repeat recipes in books. A lot of people may not have seen your blog. I would say as long as it's about 30% new material, 30 to 40% new material, I think it's fine to repeat yourself. Plus, people don't necessarily want to go to the computer to read about recipes or to read about food. I mean, they do in short little, you know, for 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there, which is the purpose of a blog. But when you're really sitting down with a book, you want to take a book and open it up and sit down on the couch and or on the subway or wherever you are and read your book. So I feel like since the act of reading on a computer and opening a book is so different, even if some of the content is the same, the overall experience will be different enough that it won't overlap.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. What about creating a presence on food websites like, say, foodcandy.com or chowhound.com? Is that a good way to go too? Or?
Yes, absolutely. Because those communities will start sending your blog around. So you really need to be part of the online community. Now I'm terrible at this, and I'm also terrible at blogging, so I just want everybody to understand, you know, this is maybe I'm not the right person to be giving this advice, but I do see for the people who it works for that you develop relationships with other people, and blogging is this amazing networking thing where you meet people virtually meet them and support each other and link to each other, and you create this community that you really can benefit by picking up other readers because you're all like-minded people. You know, when you find your community, be it a writer's group or be it an online community, you work together to make the community and therefore everybody in the community bigger, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so getting into that, and I think starting out by posting on other people's blogs, by joining online message boards, you know, by submitting pieces, even unpaid pieces, to websites, is a great way to get your name out and to become part of this community, which can then help you.
Mm. Are there other websites, other food communities online that you'd recommend?
Oh, there's so many. Gosh.
And I imagine one leads to the next, too.
I mean, you know, the thing to do is to go to blogs we like on the side of the website and start reading the blogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Chow is great online. You probably all know Chow. Then there's Chow Hound, which is fun. And Chow and Chow Hound are together now, so you can go back and forth. New York Magazine has Grub Street, which, you know, as a New Yorker, I love. That's a fun blog. I think a lot of your local newspapers have blogs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're interested in the food scene around town, go to your local newspaper's blogs because you'll find a lot of good stuff. The New York Times has a great blog. And then there are some great blogs. There's this one called Orangette, which is really good. There's another one called, well, there's Food Candy, of course. There is The Wednesday Chef. Stephen Shaw has a fabulous blog. Oh, gosh, there are just so many.
Everyone needs to visit your website and start there, too.
Yes, melissaclark.net, or if you'd like to check out The Skinny, you can go to theskinnythebook.com.
Excellent. Any last words of advice for the writers listening, the writers who want to do food writing or who are already doing food writing and want to maybe go to the next level?
Well, I think I think it's important. I have a lot of people ask me, people who are writers and they want to break into food writing, and then I have a lot of chefs who are trained culinary professionals who want to become writers. And I think that what's really important is to work hard to know it from both sides. You need, as a chef, if you want to become a writer, you need to learn how to write. You need to learn your craft. You need to take writing classes. You need to develop your voice. And I think since I think that doesn't apply to most of your audience. So on the other side of things, as a writer, you know how much skill and how much craft it takes to write. You need to turn your attention to developing your skills and your crafts of cooking. And I think a lot of people who love food and who, especially people who want to write restaurant criticism and want to write feature articles, don't take enough time to really understand how food is made, how cuisine comes together. And I think taking cooking lessons is invaluable, even if you don't cook, but just invaluable to understanding your subject. You need to understand how a chef thinks. You need to understand how, you know, just to really kind of revel in the ingredients that you're writing about, even if it's you're writing about them in a very distant way. I think the hands-on approach and building your skill set in the kitchen is extremely important. So I would say if you're a writer already and you love food and you're writing about, even if you're writing about food, if you don't cook, take a cooking course. If you cook a little bit, cook more. Just try something new. Always, you know, be on the lookout for something new. And when you're experiencing it, I mean, use your every sense you have and really be in the moment when you're working with food and then try to capture that and take it back to the page. If you can get excited, then and you can translate that on the page, that's what great food writing is.
Thank you so much. That's great advice.
Thank you.
And it's been great talking to you, too, and continued good luck with your books and your projects.
Thank you.
I'll continue to look for your name and come back again.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
Thanks. That was Melissa Clark talking to us from New York, and again, her website is melissaclark.com. Her book is The Skinny, and great stuff, and a good thing to do on the second day of the new year to think about the writer's spread. I know I am. Anyway, if you'd like to know more about the show, go to my website at penonfire.com. You can email me there if you want to be on the weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Haruki Murakami, who said, "Everything passes. Nobody gets anything for keeps. And that's how we've got to live." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I will see you next week. You're listening to 88.9 KUCI in Irvine.